workers may have experienced symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder. As we recognize PTSD Awareness Month, Real Warriors Campaign volunteer Meg Mitchum, a former Army combat medic who served in Iraq, encourages fellow warriors to reach out when they need help.
The hardest step was admitting that I needed help coping with PTSD. Once I did, my command and unit fully supported me, and I was able to get the care I needed. Getting support helped me succeed in the military and now in my civilian career.
If you or a loved one is coping with an invisible wound, resources are available and they work. For more information, visit the Real Warriors campaign at realwarriors.net or call 866-966-1020.
We all have the ability to touch the lives of those around us. Moms, dads, neighbors, teachers, friends. These are the people who are always there to listen when we need to talk. Though their actions may not always be monumental, they are always felt. To someone going through a difficult time, a text, a call, or a visit can mean so much. Reach out to the veterans in your life today. Let them know they're not alone. One simple act can make all the difference. That's the power of one. If you're a veteran in crisis or know one who is, visit veteranscrisisline.net for free 24/7 confidential support. Or call 1-800-273-8255 and press 1.
Hi, this is Catherine McNamara, and you're listening to My Dad on All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
For those of you who know, you hear that song, and it's only identified with one thing. At least for me it is. That is the Gary Owen, and that is the theme of the adopted song of the 7th Cavalry. So when I heard it growing up as a kid, what was that Errol Flynn movie? They Died With Their Boots On? This is the longer version of it. They Died With Their Boots On. You know, the romanticized version of Custer. His wife, Libby, who's an incredible historical figure in and of herself, she wrote a number of books, his devoted wife, defended his legend, and wrote some of the most detailed accounts of life on the plains as she moved to the Bismarck Mandan area of North Dakota and lived at a fort called Fort Lincoln that is still there. Yeah, historic song. This is not the orchestra, not just the drum and fife dudes. It's kind of interesting when you go to forts like Fort Bliss is one, right? Down in El Paso, at the center of the fort is still, I mean, it was a big cavalry post at one time down on the border, and they still have the huge like quad where they would hold reviews of troops. So anyway, welcome to the battle study on Battle Little Bighorn. So, and we may do a few of these, right? So today would be the first installment. And what I want to do is just audio paint for you a general picture of the outline of the campaign, and then you're gonna kind of move the rotate the kaleidoscope so you see it from a variety of different perspectives. You'll get the gist, and then you know later, and then what I'll endeavor to do is bring authors on to talk about this, because obviously there's nobody left that was there. So we'll talk about it, and what is fair criticism, what is unfair criticism of the famed leader of the 7th Cavalry, Lieutenant Colonel George Armstrong Custer. So what we're going to do is you're going to listen to a thing done by Sunday morning on 60 Minutes. Okay, so it's kind of, it's not hardcore history, but you're going to hear noted historians and authors talk about the what happened on the banks of the Little Bighorn River in south central Montana. So sit back, relax, and then after that, we'll go to the battlefield itself, and you'll hear a guide giving his pitch. And he, if you see the video, the pitch is he's standing there with an audience seated in folding chairs outside of the visitor center, and it sits above and adjacent to the Last Stand Hill, where Custer's element that he led that day of 211 were all killed in action. So you'll hear that, and then you'll hear a couple of pieces to kind of move the give the Native American perspective in a little bit fuller way. And so at the end of today, what I would hope is you would have a pretty decent understanding of the basic elements of the fight. The major players that you hear on the opposing side are Sitting Bull and Crazy Horse. And you will you'll hear different your understanding of what you understand of them as leaders will change. Crazy Horse, combat leader. Sitting Bull, spiritual leader. So you'll hear about that today. So, but it's, I find it riveting history in addition to very, very interesting combat decision-making by a combat leader. So, sit back, relax, and you'll hear me bust into this as I care to editorialize as we go. So, battlefield studies, I love doing them. Here is from the CBS newsroom, a look at Custer's last stand at the Battle of Little Bighorn.
The 141st anniversary of Custer's last stand is next Sunday. It turns out there's more to the story of that epic battle, as Moraka now tells us.
Every summer, along the banks of Montana's Little Bighorn River, the strains of the 7th Cavalry's fight song are heard. As Colonel George Armstrong Custer leads a bold charge on an Indian encampment, reenacting the battle that took place here on June 25th, 1876.
The sky is raining arrows, gunfire, smoke, yelling, screaming,
That's the guy you'll hear in a little bit. He's a National Park guy, pretty good at doing dramatic interpretation.
Ranger Steve Adelson describes a terrifying cauldron of fear and violence.
Two Moons of Cheyenne Chief. We swirled around the soldiers like water around a stone. How long did the battle last? He said about as long as it takes for a hungry man to eat his dinner.
In little more than an hour, Custer and more than 200 of his men were dead. The battle itself was short and decisive, its legacy anything but. And the man at the center, says historian Nathaniel Philbrick, is as fiercely debated as ever.
Custer's a lightning rod. He's one of those guys at the time he was living. People either loved him, worshipped him, or despised him, thought he was a fool.
I think he was always reckless, but I think he was lucky, and his luck ran out right here.
So you think Custer just rushed in?
Yeah, he thought we were going to leave, you know? But little did he know, he was entering the biggest encampment in Indian country.
Even though he captured more battle flags, more for Confederate prisoners than any other officer during the war, the single day of his life, the last day, is what he's remembered for.
And how that day and Custer are remembered has changed over time.
When I was a kid, he was the hero. Because I had seen They Died With Their Boots On, Heroic Betrayal. Then I think I was a freshman in high school, and I saw a Little Big Man. You go! Custer is the deranged maniac, a caricature almost of a Vietnam-era imperialist.
As a youth, Custer didn't seem destined for greatness.
He finished last in his class at West Point?
Yes, and he knows how to play the game of how bad can I behave and not get kicked out. And so for him, he was playing that line.
Who finished first in his class?
Exactly.
There Who you cares? Go.
But Custer's bravery in battle was unquestioned. A brigadier general for the Union Army at 23, he became a Civil War hero.
And at Gettysburg, he has his horse shot from underneath him?
Yeah, it was looking like the Confederates just might pull it off. The only person between them and that fate was Custer. And Custer and his Wolverines, the Michiganders, unleashed an incredible charge.
Is he an adrenaline junkie?
Custer loved the thrill of anything. And there was nothing more thrilling than being in battle.
Except, perhaps, dressing up in black velvet uniforms adorned with gold braid.
There are more pictures of Custer than any figure at that time. He's so vain, and he knows how to work the camera. I mean, this is the social media of its day.
He would have been a monster on Instagram.
Yes, Instagram, and, you know, he could have done pretty well on Twitter, too.
But by 1876, the Custer luster had faded. A military victory out west could restore some of that shine.
He's 36. He's towards the end of his career. He's been dabbling in the stock market, silver mines, losing his shirt. He's got hopes of a lecture tour if he can come back a hero. He's desperate.
And the country, preparing to celebrate its centennial, was desperate too for Indian land, including the gold-rich Black Hills of the Dakota Territory. Land sacred to the Lakota that the U.S. government had only years before granted them forever.
The stakes were literally life and death for the Lakota. Their buffalo population upon which they depended had been decimated. The last remaining significant herd was in Montana, and that's why the Battle Little Bighorn would be fought in that location.
The story you're going to hear is the Indian version of the Battle of the Little Bighorn.
Part of the battle took place on land owned today by brothers Jim and Henry Reelbird.
We just swam along the river, and then we would find bullets and shell casings. That's from the battle.
Their family has staged the annual reenactment for 26 years now.
How was the battle taught in school when you were growing up?
Just mentioned briefly in the encyclopedia like that, and that's all there was to it.
What we do know is that Custer met his match in Chief Sitting Bull.
45 years old, too old to fight, but not to lead. He exhorts the warriors on. Brave up! Brave up! Strong hearts to the front, cowards to the rear. Hokahay! It's a good day to die.
On that late June morning, Custer was undaunted by reports that his men were outnumbered by the Indians.
He's gone up against insurmountable odds oftentimes during the Civil War and come out victorious by being aggressive.
And on top of the ridge, Custer.
But the Indians didn't run, and they did fight.
Eagle bone whistles shrieking across the battlefield in the dust and the smoke. It was apocalyptic chaos.
George Armstrong Custer's mutilated body was recovered days later.
According to Native oral tradition, his ears had been pierced with awls so that he could hear better in the afterlife.
The expression on his face?
A smile. A triumphant smile. And that is just the mystery of Custer.
The victory for the Indians was short-lived. Within 2 years, most were confined to reservations.
This was a battle over
land, without a doubt, land. Who would occupy it, how it would be used, and who would be allowed to traverse across it.
At the Little Bighorn Battlefield National Monument, Custer's men are memorialized where they fell. The Indian warriors who lost their lives are remembered, too, on what is today known as Last Stand Hill.
This place talks to you. You don't have to strain to hear it. And there's a mystical aura to it. It is a spiritual place.
All right, there is a... So it's kind of an overview from CBS News, all right? You're going to hear that guy, that last voice you heard, you're going to hear him now. He is a park ranger at the Little Bighorn National Park. But let me give you some information about if I were to give you an orientation about the battle, this is what I would give you, all right? Relative to Indian movements and the way the Indians behaved as American cavalry units attempted to surround them and get at them, all right, and fight them. From Phil Sheridan winds up being, I believe he's Meade and then Grant's cavalry guy. Let me make sure I'm saying this right. And that's how he knows Custer. Sheridan and Custer are a lifelong. Sheridan, right? As in the tank, right? As in Fort Sheridan. Same guy, right? He's a cavalry guy. Let's see. His career was noted for his rapid rise to become a major general and his close association with U.S. Grant, who transferred Sheridan from command of an infantry division in the Western Theater to lead cavalry in the Army of the Potomac in the East. So there you have it. And Custer serves under Sheridan. Anyway, so from General Sheridan down to the newest lieutenant, the great worry was that the hostiles would evade the column sent after them. Rarely, unless absolutely certain of victory, did the Plains Indian stand and fight. Usually he faded into the hills and easily eluded his slow-moving pursuers. Thus, military planning focused mainly on how to catch the quarry rather than how to defeat him once caught. Sheridan's plans assumed that each of the converging columns, and there's three of them, so again, go to the read board, click on the map, right? There's a small map which just serves the website and and particularly the cell phone aspect of a website. I've updated the map so that you can see kind of the Little Bighorn campaign as conceived by General Terry, right, who was one of Sheridan's subordinates out west. Okay, Sheridan's plans assumed three converging columns could handle any gathering of hostiles it succeeded in bringing to battle. In all the unceded territory, according to the Indian Bureau, the warrior force did not exceed 800, and the possibility that these might unite in one place was not seriously considered. So when you put together the estimate of the situation, right, the number that we're looking at is 800, and that all those 800 would be in one place is not seriously considered. The fact that there might be between 2,000 and 4,000 warriors in one spot, Not a thought in anybody's head. All the Teton Sioux were present. The Hunkpapas, under Sitting Bull, Gall, Crow King, and Black Moon. Oglalas, under Crazy Horse, Low Dog, and Big Road. The Minikonju followers of Hemp. Sanzark, Blackfoot, and Brule Sioux. There were also Northern Cheyennes under Two Moon, Lame White Men, and Dirty Moccasins, and a handful of warriors from tribes of the Eastern Sioux. They clustered around six separate tribal circles, and altogether they numbered between 10,000 and 12,000 people, mustering a fighting force of between 2,500 and 4,000. Many had firearms, some the Winchester repeating rifle obtained quite legally from traders and Indian agents for hunting. The Battle of the Rosebud infused the Indians with confidence, right? And this happened on the morning of June 17th. General Crook, right? And if you look at your map, you'll see Crook, right? He's moving from the south to the north. Custer is moving from the northeast to the southwest, converging. And then there's another column under General Gibbon moving from the northwest to the southeast. Right, so you got kind of two moving, converging from the north to a center point, and then you have one moving from the south. So on June 17th, right, General Crook's column collided with an array of fighters, right, and in a fight that lasted most of the day, Crook turns back and marches back to what was called Goose Creek at the time. It's now Sheridan, Wyoming, where they built Fort Sheridan. He called for reinforcements. The Indians returned to their teepees in triumph, and at once moved down Reno Creek, which is towards the Little Bighorn, and laid out a new camp, which would be the camp that Custer would find. It lined the west bank of the river, the Little Bighorn River, for 3 miles and sprawled in places all the way across the mile-wide valley. Gives you some idea of how big the encampment was. The Battle of the Rosebud infused the Indians with confidence, and well it might, for it had thrown back one of Sheridan's columns and prevented its juncture with the others. Of the proximity of the others, however, the hostiles had no idea. Hostiles meaning Indian. While of their location, the military commanders had formed a nearly correct idea. On the very day of the Battle of the Rosebud, Major Reno had examined the broad Indian trail in the Rosebud Valley, and even as the Sioux and Cheyenne were moving to their village on the Little Bighorn, Terry, Gibbon, and Custer laid plans to smash it. Okay, so kind of the general situation. Three converging columns. The Indians fight Crook towards the south, and they essentially defeat him and turn him back, and then they move north, ultimately winding up on the Little Bighorn. Okay. On the evening of June 21st, General Terry gathered his principal subordinates in the cabin of the Far West, which is a steamer, right? Headed down the Yellowstone River, right, in Montana. That was his command post, right? It's moored on the bank of the Yellowstone River at the mouth of the Rosebud River, right, and which is where Custer will depart from. Together, they worked out the details of the strategy that had already been formed, right, for snaring the Indians whose trail Reno had seen in the Rosebud Valley. Two fundamental assumptions, and these are interesting, right, shaped the plan, that the enemy probably numbered less than 1,000 warriors, and that unless surrounded and forced into battle, they would flee to the mountains as soon as they were discovered, as soon as they discovered the approach of the soldiers. So, interesting, right? So, less than 1,000 And our biggest problem is going to be getting around them and surrounding them because they're not going to fight. The plan was for these three columns to converge and deal with this group simultaneously. Custer obviously changes the plan. Much is made of scouts. There's two groups of scouts that Custer has. All right, Crow scouts were more familiar with the area, with the region. Right, they knew the land better. They came from General Gibbons. Custer was not as familiar with them. The Arikara scouts, they were organic to Custer. Were not as familiar with the area. So when you read about this, when you listen to it, you'll hear conflicting accounts from scouts, and you think, well, wait a minute. I thought they said this. I thought they said that. They said both. So there you have it. It's interesting that you hear in that first clip, Custer had been lucky and he was combat lucky. And his instinct was, when in doubt, be aggressive. And so you'll see the flavor of that here, changing plans, relying on his own audacity and boldness in combat. But to me, he's a mobile unit. He's not a tank. He's a cav guy. And to say he gets over his skis is a little bit, I think, he's been over his skis as a commander for most of his career. And it always works out. So, this is from the National Park Service. And this is their guide recreating the Battle of the Little Bighorn. So, we'll listen to that. And I'll stop it as I choose. So, stand by.
Well, folks, this is an incredible story. It's a story that attracts 400,000 people a year from all over the world come through that gate. The vast majority of them, 90% of the time, never been here in their lives. I'd like to see who you are this morning. If you've never been here in your life, please put your hand up. Now hold it way up. Now just look around. It's always the same. 90% of the folks come here, never been here in their life, and yet except for these little tykes over here, there's nobody in this audience who's never heard of George Armstrong Custer. There's nobody in this audience who's never heard of Sitting Bull or Crazy Horse. And I promise you this, there's nobody here who's never heard of Elvis Presley. Well, folks, it's a simple story, and yet it's a complex story. You are on the battlefield right now, and it stretches 5 miles to the south of us, well beyond the notch in the hill way out there. 5 miles. On June 25th, 1876, George Armstrong Custer with 647 troops will attack a massive camp located about a mile and a half to 2 miles to the south of us, down in the river valley bottom. There's 8,000 people in that village. 1,500 to 2,000 of them are warriors. Custer's going to have 647 troops. It's the only battlefield in the country, only one of two in the whole world, where white markers indicate where soldiers were killed on the battlefield and buried where they fell. Red markers, like the one at the mouth of Deep Ravine, just to the left of this gentleman. 17 warrior markers across the battlefield. Much more warriors died in the fight. But we've got 17 markers placed there by oral histories and families. They're not buried on the battlefield. They're picked up very quickly and later buried in trees and caves and scaffolding. On top of the hill, just below the monument, Custer perishes at the age of 36 years old. Buried in an 18-inch grave. Disinterred.
heard a year later what was left of him, placed in a box about this big, taken back to West Point where he's buried today. 5 years after the battle, skeletal remains all over the ground, scraped up by a reburial detail, placed in a mass grave on top of the hill in 1881 where the monument now stands. Across the street, the Indian Memorial, dedicated in 2003 to the warriors and tribes who fought here in a desperate attempt to hang on to their very way of life. And behind us, a national cemetery with the remains of nearly 5,000 veterans and their families not related to the battle, like Arlington veterans, Spanish-American War, World War I, World War II, Korea, and Vietnam, closed in 1978, full to capacity today. Well, folks, it's quiet here now. It's peaceful. There's tranquility here. But 137 years ago, on the back of that ridge, it was far from quiet. In fact, it was apocalyptic chaos. Gunfire, smoke, yelling, screaming, cursing, more ammo, more ammo, eagle bone whistle shrieking across the battlefield in the dust and the smoke. Warriors getting closer and closer and closer, desperately trying to destroy the soldier command. Apocalypse, that little bighorn, Custer's final battle. How did this happen? Why did it happen? Well, folks, it's really a culminating event because it marks nearly 400 years of cultural animosity, cultural friction, cultural disdain between Euro-Americans and Native Americans, and the fight was always over the same thing. Land. Land. Who would occupy it? How it would be used? And who would be allowed to traverse across it? Because you see, when Euro-Americans come out west, they see huge expanses of territory. And they see grass and water and timber and minerals in the ground, particularly that yellow metal that makes a white man go crazy. And when they see all of these resources, they envision farms and towns, ranches, railroads, telegraphs, Cheryl, and barbed wire fences. All of it driven by a near religion called Manifest Destiny. Manifest Destiny, the belief that somehow Euro-Americans are sanctioned, they're ordained by God to spread across the continent. Conquer it, subdue it, tame it, from coast to coast, from sea to shining sea. There's just one problem with that vision. There's people already here. And they have their own vision of what life should be like. And I'm going to argue this. They're the freest people on earth. Because when they get horses in the early 1700s, they can go from Mexico to Canada in pursuit of huge herds of the 1,400-pound super-walking Walmart store of the plains. Food, shelter, clothing, weapons, utensils, fuel, medicines, and about 50 other uses. And by the way, ladies and gentlemen, in 1840, there are 60 million buffalo on the plains. And by 1890, less than 500 left on the planet. When Euro-Americans come out west, they want to turn the Sioux and the Cheyenne and the Arapaho and the Blackfoot and the Crow, they want to turn them into Christian farmers. Well, Sitting Bull's not about to bend over and scratch and claw at the ground with a hoe to try to make a living. And Crazy Horse is not going to surrender his pony and hook it up to a plow. They're hunters and their warriors. And that's their vision. Folks, in the mid-1870s, 1873, there's an economic crisis. The stock market crashes. The banking system rolls over. The panic of 1873. People are losing their jobs, their life savings. There's 20% unemployment. Does any of that ring a bell? It's tough times in America. Ulysses S. Grant is the president of the United States. He's going to have to rev up the economy or he's not going to get reelected. He needs an economic stimulus package. And George Custer is going to provide it. Gold in the Black Hills. The summer of 74, Custer leads an expedition into the Black Hills, western South Dakota. Rumors of gold had persisted for years, but now it is a reality. There's gold in the Black Hills. Newspaper reports say all you got to do is walk through the grass and pick up nuggets off the tops of your shoes. Miners, prospectors, entrepreneurs pour into the hills overnight. Deadwood, 3,000-4,000 people real quick. Every one of them is an illegal alien because the Black Hills belong to the Sioux. Guaranteed by the Treaty of 1868, a white man's promise. No white people allowed in the Black Hills. Wild Bill Hickok, shot in the back of the head playing cards in Number 10 Saloon in Deadwood, he's an illegal alien. So is his friend Calamity Jane. Because the Sioux call the hills Paha Sapa, sacred ground. Literal translation, the hills are black with timber. Well, President Grant sees an opportunity there. He wants to get at that gold, rev up the economy, create jobs, put money in the treasury. So he's going to try to buy the Black Hills. $7 million, that's a lot of money. But Sitting Bull, Crazy Horse, Ice, Lame White Man, others. No, not for sale. You don't sell the ground that your ancestors walked on. And now their bones lie beneath. Not for sale. Well, how about if we lease them? We'll give them back when we're done. No thanks. In frustration, Grant hands the problem over to the War Department, the architects of a military campaign to sweep the Sioux back onto reservations in the Dakotas. It's going to be designed by two old Civil War comrades, William Tecumseh Sherman and Phil Sheridan. If you remember, folks, those two old boys burned down half the South in the war between the states. They know what total war is, and they're going to try to wage it again on the northern plains. They're going to issue an ultimatum to the Sioux. It's pretty straightforward. It goes like this. Get out of the Black Hills. Get out of the Powder River country. Get out of the Rosebud country. And go back to your respective reservations in the Dakotas and stay there. And do so by January 31st, 1876, because if you don't, you're going to be considered hostile. And the army will come and get you and force you to return. Runners are sent out to inform the villages of this edict, but it's a bitter winter, the winter of 75 and 76. Howling winds, drifting snow, 45 below zero, not uncommon on the northern plains. You're not going to move a village. There's no grass for the ponies. But more commanding than the weather itself is the counsel from Sitting Bull, who says to the people, don't go back. Don't go back to that reservation and make yourself a slave to a piece of fat bacon and some coffee and sugar. Stay out. Live like a real Indian while you still can. Hunt buffalo while they still exist. He knew the sun was going down, and so they stayed out. They didn't go back. And by the early spring, those who'd wintered on the agencies began to trickle off and reinforce Sitting Bull and Crazy Horse out here. And by the early summer, they're pouring off the reservations. So much so that once again we've got this village 2 miles to the south of us. 8,000 people in it. 1,500 to 2,000 warriors. They're not going back to bad flour and rotten meat and starvation on the reservation. They're going to stay out here. The stage is set. 8 o'clock in the morning, George Armstrong Custer is up on those Wolf Mountains, way out there on the far horizon, 15 miles out, a place called the Crow's Nest. His scouts, Arickaras and Crows, have gotten up on top there, and they've looked down in the wee hours of the morning, and they've seen smoke rising from the teepees. They think it's a big camp. They go get Custer. He doesn't believe him. He wants to see for himself. He goes up to the crow's nest at 8 o'clock in the morning, looks down into the valley with a cheap spyglass. But he can't see a thing because the breakfast campfires have turned the valley into Los Angeles. The scouts tell him, look for worms in the grass. Well, folks, the Little Bighorn River is right below us, that thick green line of trees at the bottom of the ridge. Across the valley to the second line of trees, above those trees on the bluffs of the morning of the 25th, there's 20,000 horses grazing. 20,000 worms in the grass. Custer can't see them. The scouts are very alarmed. You better not go down there. You don't have enough bullets in your whole command to fight the Sioux. But other scouts see it differently. You better attack because that village is going to run. They're going to scatter. They're not going to fight. Custer's favorite scout, Bloody Knife and Arikara, says to him in sign, General, if you and I go down there today, we'll go home on a road we've never walked before. Custer says, I think we can get through all of them in one day. Fearless, aggressive, relentless, vain, arrogant, overconfident, a glory hunter. Well, folks, for 137 years, he's been judged by one battle. His last one. However, the record shows that he has been in battle after battle after fight after battle in the American Civil War. 100 engagements. He's had 11 horses shot right out from underneath him. Saber charges. No scars. Sometimes he's so far out ahead of his men, he's in Confederate territory all by himself. When Lee surrenders to Grant in the spring of 65, surrender documents are signed, ceremonies concluded. When it's all over with, Phil Sheridan picks up the table that the documents were signed on, later presents it to Elizabeth Custer with these words, I don't know of anyone who has played a greater role than ending this tragic conflict than your gallant husband. That table is in the Smithsonian today. Arrogant, vain, overconfident, aggressive, fearless, relentless, legendary, the boy general, Brigadier 23, Major General 26. He leads thousands of men into battle time after time after time. His success, the adulation he receives, the recognition, is going to contribute to his death certificate on the back of that ridge. Custer decides he's going to attack. He orders Captain Frederick Benteen off to the south to scout with 120 men, three companies. Benteen hates Custer's guts, has no use for him. Benteen questions his orders. General, if this village is as big as they say it is, we're going to need every man we've got. You have your orders, Benteen. Follow them. You're dismissed. Benteen hates Custer. Custer hates Benteen. Reno hates both of them. Reno and Custer come off the divide 12 miles out, 7 miles out, 3 miles out from the river crossing. The scout Girard sees 60 warriors racing towards the village in the north. He screams out, there go your Indians, General! And they're running like devils. Custer sends an immediate order to Major Marcus Reno, second in command. Major Reno, the village is just ahead and running away. Move forward at as rapid a gait as you deem prudent. Pitch into anything. Sweep everything before you. And you'll be supported by the whole outfit. Reno crosses the stream. He cinches up his equipment, tightens his saddle girths, and charges down the valley towards the massive camp 4 miles beyond. He's got 140 men. Inside the village, It's chaos. They didn't expect to fight. They're caught off guard. When the village criers see the soldiers, they scream out, "Ota! Ota! Ota! The charges are coming! The long knives! The blue coats!" Old women hobbling on sticks, trying to get away. Young mothers frantically racing around, trying to find their children, who are swimming and playing. Inside the camp, Sitting Bull, 45 years old, spirit warrior, too old to fight, but not to lead. He exhorts the warriors on. "Brave up! Brave up! Strong hearts, to the front! Cowards, to the rear! Hokahay, it's a good day to die." 14, 15-year-olds race out of the village on horseback. They tie sagebrush to the backs of their ponies' tails and ride back and forth, creating a giant dust cloud. As Reno thunders down the valley faster and faster and faster, at 700 yards, he knows two things. Number one, the village is not running away. And number two, he's never fought the Sioux and the Cheyenne before. At 400 yards, he will scream out, "Halt! Dismount! Form skirmish lines now! Fight on foot!" 140 men attempt to rein their horses in at 20 miles an hour. Private Smith and Turley, two city boys, they don't know how to ride too well. They can't even stop. They go right into the camp. Their heads later found on poles. 138 men dig in. Every fourth man is a horse holder. He takes his horse and three others, pulls them off the battle line, back into the timber along the river, protect horses and ammunition from the advancing warriors. Now that cuts down the firing line to 90 soldiers spread across the valley floor in 5-yard intervals, skirmish line formation. And in 10 minutes, they'll face 600 warriors.
Okay, if you listen to that math, that's bad math. And as I said before, one of the challenges of cavalry units is that they're not heavy. They're not infantry units. And as a leader in those organizations, you have to be mindful of that. And so Reno, I said before, relative to military decision-making, when you see indicators that contradict your assumptions, you better act quick. And he doesn't. They don't. Right? And as you listen to this, you can wrap Custer in Army doctrine and make a case that he did what he should have done. You can wrap him in a different lens and say, you know, he was horrible. My own opinion is, in order to understand the things he did that day, you have to understand him and the way he's behaved throughout his whole life. And if you understand him and the way he's behaved in command his whole life, you quickly see that he's consistent there, as he was with, you know, the rest of his life as a commander. And, you know, sadly, I mean, he and his entire command pay the price. I would make the case that you could argue that Custer should have been dead years ago. He should have been dead years ago. He was just combat lucky. He was one of those guys. And as one of those guys, you know, he behaved a certain way. And ultimately, you know, he pays a price for it. But, I mean, he should have been dead, you know. The law of probability says he should have been dead years ago. He should have been dead in the Civil War at some point. Leading charges? Come on. So, anyway, back to the back to the Rangers. So Reno's, so if you look at the map, right, so bear with me. So go to the map, right? It's a lower map, and then click on it and go to the website. It'll give you an exploded version of the map. So you can see on the eastern edge of the map as they go down the Little Bighorn River. Reno's under the impression that Custer's going to reinforce what he's doing, right? Custer has fragged himself and is now, right, on the glorious flanking movement, like Maximus executed in Gladiator. So you see Reno's first position in the valley, right, where he's attacked. You see him move, and then you see them take off. And ultimately, they, you know, there's a debacle, an uncontrolled river crossing. It's not like you have an overwatch element that's protecting people as they move through the river. It is a route. They, you know, so, and you'll hear him go through it, but they go through the river, and then they wind up in a defensive position called Reno's Hill, where Benteen will join him. They'll dig in. They'll spend the next 24 or 36 hours there in a kind of a crescent on a hill. And they form a 360 defense up there. But my point here is that you don't have to be a genius. And when you hear the math, there's 138 of them, right? You have a quarter of them holding horses. So what's left? 90 shooters is what's left. Yeah, it's bad math. And all of a sudden, you know, you thought you were, you know, the baddest guy around, and now you're going to get your pants pulled down because now you're going to have to fight on foot against somebody who's of equal size or better. And so it's the art, really, of the cavalry thing, which is, you know, making sure a little bit, and again, this is a little bit easier, right, a little bit softer into the fight till you know what you have, and then you adjust. If it's small enough for you to handle, then you handle it. If it's not, right, then you attempt to fix it and shape it for an infantry force, a tank force that follows you. And then during the Civil War, it would have been an infantry force that would follow you and destroy that element that you're not big enough that you don't have the ass to deal with, right? That you're not thick enough to deal with. So that's really the art and the interesting thing about the decision making that goes on here. Right. But in my opinion, Custer believes he's a tank. He doesn't see himself as cavalry. And I don't know that he ever did. So anyway, we continue.
The company commanders order volley fire. They take their big bore Springfield carbine, 45-55 trapdoor single shot. It shoots a big bullet. And if it hits you, you're going down. And most likely some of your anatomy is going to fall off. They open the trap, drop the cartridge into the breech, close the trap, cock the weapon, ready, aim, fire, boom, 90 guns go off. Open the trap, eject the spent cartridge, throw a fresh round in, close the trap, cock the weapon, ready, aim, fire, boom, another 90 rounds go off. Big bullets rumbling into the village, crashing into the teepees, and dropping some of them on the ground. Inside the village, a warrior named Gaul. Gaul is painting himself up for war. He's 6 feet tall, and he weighs 250 pounds. His two wives and three daughters are killed by Reno's charge. When he found out, he said, "It made my heart bad, and I fought back with a hatchet." Gaul, Crow King, Two Moon, Low Dog, Crazy Horse, they roar out of the village like angry bees out of a hive and slam into Reno. After 20 minutes, Reno collapses and falls back into the timber. He digs in for a second stand, but now the warriors light the grass on fire behind him. They snap buffalo blankets and run off his horses. He's feeling very, very uncomfortable. He finally screams out to the scout Bloody Knife. Bloody Knife, what are the Indians going to do? Boom! Bloody Knife takes a bullet right in the head. His hot brains and blood go all over Reno's face. Right then and there, Major Marcus Reno invented the modern term, post-traumatic stress syndrome. He barks out conflicting orders. Mom!
That was funny?
Mount! Dismount! Mount! Guys are going up and down. And then he screams out, those who want to make their escape and live, follow me. He crashes out of the timber, races back towards the river 4 miles beyond. Other soldiers are trying to catch up. It's a rout. There's no attempt to cover the retreat at all. Warriors race up next to the fleeing soldiers and pump their Winchester and Henry repeating rifles into the command. Bow, 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 bow! Two Moon said, we mowed the soldiers down. It was like a buffalo hunt. We came up behind the soldiers. We slipped our bowstrings over the soldiers' heads and jerked them off their horses, pounded them with clubs, and took their guns. And we counted coup, which means to touch an enemy with a stick. You're not brave. Why are you here? You did not bring enough soldiers. You better go back and get more. 40 men will die in this race with death through a gauntlet of hell. They get to the river crossing. Horses plunge off the bank, crash into the stream, flounder, and men drown. Warriors on top of the ridges rained bullets into the crossing. Ladies and gentlemen, the river was red with blood.
All right, where's Custer, who was supposed to follow him? That's what his understanding was. Custer frags himself, and as he enters from the east, right, Custer is looping on the other side of the bluffs that overlook the Little Bighorn River. And depending on what you want to think of Custer, either he's gonna drop the grand stroke of the flanking attack, or he's moving to cut them off. If you give him the benefit of the doubt, he's moving to cut this large group off, right? And for whatever reason, he doesn't see the danger in the size of this. Now again, remember, he got mixed reviews from his mixed messages from his scouts. What's down there is huge. And they would have known that by simply the size of the amount of, you know, earth that was disturbed by this mass of people that were moving. It would not have taken a genius, be you Native American, from whatever tribe, or white, to look at the width of whatever was there and say, hey, there's multiples of what we've ever seen before. So, and then as the guide said, when they're up at the crow's nest, right, and the scouts are saying, there's huge number of people down there. Custer gets his spyglass out, you know, that nautical looking thing, and he looks and he doesn't see it. And so, you know, he thinks they're prone to exaggerate anyway. So very interesting. So, but if you're asking the question, so where the hell's Custer? Custer and again, this whole thing takes about 60 minutes. Custer's going to be dead within the hour, right? Custer's moving parallel to the Little Bighorn to the north of Reno, you know, going to either cut them off or execute a flanking maneuver.
This was war. It wasn't cowboys and Indians. It wasn't John Wayne. It was war. Reno scratches and thrashes across the river, climbs out onto the bank, gets on top of the high ground 5 miles to the south of us. This road will take you right to it. He is a fractured commander, and his battalion is whipped and demoralized. About 10 minutes later, Captain Benteen approaches Reno on the high bluff after scouting to the south. He sees Reno and snarls, where's Custer? Reno says, I don't know where Custer is, but for God's sake, Benteen, halt your command and help me. I've lost half my men. Benteen has a message in his pocket. It's from Custer, delivered to Benteen on the back trail by Giovanni Martini, the Italian orderly of the day who has a real tough time with English. Benteen.
Martini is the last person to see Custer in his column alive. He's given a message and told to get to Benteen, tell him to come quickly, yada, yada, yada. So Martini's the last person with Custer that survives.
Benteen hands a note to Reno. It reads, Benteen, come quick. Come on, big village. Bring packs. P.S. Bring packs. Ammunition packs. Neither one of those officers is going to respond with any sense of urgency to that order, and it will haunt them for the rest of their days. In the meantime, Custer advances to the north with five companies, 209 men. He tries to go down off the ridge and cross the river at Medicine Tail Coulee. 2.5 miles to the south of us, it's a low point in the valley, a freeway crossing into the Cheyenne camp, but Cheyenne warriors slam the gate closed. Custer has to retreat and fall back up the ridge where all five companies gather at a place called Calhoun Hill. Today, if you'll lend me your eyes, I want to show you where that is.
Now, this to me is where, to me, Custer fails. Now, Custer's seeing indications that, A, they're going to stand and fight, B, there's a lot of them. He turns his five companies, I think it's five, he turns his five companies around, and he tries to bounce, right? Bounce further to the north. And ain't happening. It ain't happening. Bounce further to the west. And so, and again, why? Why is he not seeing what's there? What's plain as day in front of him, right? So the order he's executed is he knows Reno's fighting. He can hear it to behind him and as he turns to his left. And now, so that you would think, if he has the element of surprise, he's going to find an open flank. What does he find? Ba-boom. Now, again, if you're a cavalryman, you got 200 dudes, you just saw more than 200 of them. So, again, when I say he had a bad day as a decision maker, even if you give him the benefit of the doubt here, right, he still has a chance. He still has a chance to save his 220-odd soldiers, scouts, and everybody who's with him.
Okay, we've got the monument. We go south along the monument. We see that SUV on the ridge. By the way, that wasn't here in 76. We drop down the ridge, and then it rises up. Three clumps of green brush. Can you see it out there, folks? It's a big country. Three clumps of green brush. Just beyond there is Calhoun Hill. James Calhoun, Custer's brother-in-law. With about 85 soldiers, he forms a skirmish line facing the south. And for 45 minutes, he flails away trying to hold warriors back. But then Gaul, Crow King, Two Moon, Low Dog, Crazy Horse, after pounding Reno into hopeless submission, they peel off of Reno, roar down, and slam into Calhoun Hill like a red tidal wave. Company L and James Calhoun are blown off the ridge. 1,000 yards out in front of us, C Company mounts their horses and charges down the hill, driving warriors back. They dismount and form a skirmish line and fire into the fleeing warriors. Temporarily, there's a change in momentum. But a Southern Cheyenne chief named Lame White Man, he gets off his horse in the middle of the battlefield, turns to the fleeing warriors and says, "Come back! Come back! There's not that many soldiers! We can kill them all!" They rally up behind Lame White Man, storm back up the ridge, and crash into C Company. They snap buffalo blankets and run off C Company horses, and they kill their horse holders. Most of the C Company boys are cut down, those few left alive, unhorsed. And they run to the top of Battle Ridge. Hordes of warriors race down the west side of the river and cross right below us that deep ravine. They pound up the ridge 200 yards out in front of us and go right up on top of the ridge. They look down, hearing gunfire on the other side, and they see Crazy Horse Crazy Horse is fearless, aggressive, relentless, and he is hostile to any white intrusion into the Powder River country. He's also 36 years old, the same age as Custer, and he has no fear. Because as a kid, he's had a vision. The Great Spirit comes to him in a dream at the age of 14 and says, you're to protect your people. Bullets and arrows will never harm you. You will not die from a bullet or an arrow. But be humble. Don't boast or brag. Don't draw attention to yourself. A very tough assignment in a warrior culture that's much like the NFL. Crazy Horse charges down the ridge and goes right into the teeth of Miles Keogh, the Fighting Irishman. Company I commander, 45 dismounted skirmishers fire at Crazy Horse. Boom! They don't hit him. They reload a second time. White Bull does a bravery run right in front of Keogh. Boom! They don't hit him either. The other warriors, inspired by the courage of Crazy Horse and White Bull, charge down the ridge, slam into Keogh, and grind Company I into Gaul, who's overrun Calhoun Hill from the south. Company I ceases to exist. The only remnants of the firefight, 45 white tombstones on the other side of the hill, they look like ghosts in a lunch line. One survivor, a horse named Comanche, Miles Keogh's horse, shot full of holes, leaking blood all over the prairie. They find it down by the river, sucking in water, but more is leaking out than it can take in. The horse is put on the boat far west, taken back to Fort Abraham Lincoln. That horse will live another 16 years. Never ridden again. The only time a saddle touches that horse's back is in a funeral with boots pointed backwards. And by the way, folks, that horse ate apple pie whenever it wanted. It's resting in a glass case now in Lawrence, Kansas. Calhoun is dead. Keogh crushed. Lieutenant Colonel Custer swings out beyond us with probably 80 soldiers. He's going to go out through the current cemetery, drop down off the ridge, try to cross the river and capture the women and children and screaming old people who have fled to the north to escape Reno's charge. Lots of warrior accounts testify to this maneuver.
Which is, I mean, this thing is not headed marginally south. All right. You have every indicator in front of you that you're going to lose your command.
But he can't get across the river. Once again, veterans, Sioux and Cheyennes turn him around. He has to fight his way back up through here where he drives warriors off the top of the hill and digs in where the monument now stands about the same time that Keogh caves in. And as I said, folks, at the very beginning, now the full fury of 1,500 to 2,000 warriors will bear down onto Last Stand Hill. The sky is raining arrows, gunfire, smoke, yelling, screaming, cursing, warriors getting closer and closer. Two Moon, a Cheyenne chief, we swirled around the soldiers like water around a stone. Gaul, the soldiers were fighting good. They were loading and firing and loading and firing. But 35 or 40 of them on gray horses bolted off the ridge. They went down into the ravine, and we killed them all. 28 dead men found after the battle in a heap at the bottom of this trail, buried in a crack in the earth. E Company, the gray horse troop. Back up on the hill, 20-year-old Cheyenne Wooden Leg. It looked like 1,000 dogs in a fight. Low Dog. The soldiers kept fighting, but then they threw their big guns on the ground. And they took out their little guns. And they tried to kill us, but they shot wildly in the sky as their horses bucked and shied and pulled them all around. A desperate order. Shoot your horse. Boom! A bullet in your horse's head. 39 dead horses found around the monument. You're not going home now. You just shot your transportation. You're hiding behind horse flesh. There's nowhere to run to. And by God, there's nowhere to hide. Warriors get closer and closer. They ask Gaul 10 years after the battle, how long did the fight last? He said about as long as it takes for a hungry man to eat his dinner and then the shots. Boom! Quit coming. Boys and old men watching in the draws and the ravines, mounted their horses, stormed up the hill, rode right into the crowd of survivors and pounded them to death. Then they raced down to meet Reno and Benteen, who had made a feeble effort to advance to the sound of the gunfire, drove them back, pinned them down, trapped them under siege for the next 24 hours. Benteen will step up for a shell-shocked Reno. It's a groundhog case, men. It's do or die. Dig rifle pits now. And they began to scratch and claw at the ground with cups and spoons and pocket knives in their hands. Those rifle pits are still there. 24 hours later, the massive village begins to break up and scatter to the south as they detect the oncoming advancing column of Gibbon and Terry from the north. And by the time the sun goes down, June 26, 1876, it's only a handful of warriors in sight. Benteen, with courage and 24,000 rounds of ammunition, has saved 350 on that hill to the south. 263 are dead. Between 60 and 100 warriors have been killed in this battle, maybe more. We'll never know in the Battle of the Little Bighorn is over. Today, it's quiet. It's peaceful. The battle's over. The war's over. The Indian Memorial on top of the hill has done much to heal the bitterness and anger and hostility that existed for years here. Today it's quiet. There's a spirituality. It's hallowed ground. I live on the battlefield just beyond the cemetery as a ranger in ranger housing. Sometimes I'm the only person here when the sun goes down. Sometimes I'll take a walk late at night. About a month ago, the moon was bigger than I'd ever seen it. I walked up to Last Stand Hill. I could read the names on the monument. It's a spiritual place. I felt it. I feel it every day. And I hope in some small way, ladies and gentlemen, by attending our presentation here this morning, you've been introduced to the Battle of the Little Bighorn. But more importantly, you've connected with the spirit that exists here. You've been an excellent audience. I'll stick around for questions or comments. Thank you very much.
There you have it, National Park Service. Pretty good. Pretty good. And I say that pretty good. Like when you read a bunch about it, and I'll post some links that one of our listeners sent to me. When you listen to it and you do some reading about it, the account that they give, that he gives, including his dramatic interpretation, is balanced and outstanding. When he talked about Custer's when they shot their horses, some of them committed suicide in the end. And so you can't see it when he's going bow, but he put his finger to his temple and went and said bow. All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, you're going to hear it's entitled "The Good Day to Die," and it's about 24 minutes. And then after that, you're going to hear the account according to Crazy Horse. Okay, so when you think of the great Native American warriors that led that day, Sitting Bull is too old to fight. He's in his 40s. Okay. And Crazy Horse, you hear names like Crazy Horse and Gall. This dude Gall is gigantic. He's huge. And you hear these guys. I read an account that Gall, you know, wrote or was interviewed and was transcribed. Pretty interesting. Pretty interesting. And I'll read that at the end of, this thing. But we'll take a quick break. Our battle study of the Battle of Little Bighorn. And again, Custer has two chances to recock this thing and get his ass out of there. And he doesn't. And the thing's clearly not what he expected. But again, his experience in the Civil War is, you know, he pitches into it. And it runs out that day. All right, we'll take a break. More of All Marine Radio. Battlefield Study Wednesday. Coming up next on your home for it, the All Warrior Radio Network.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.
Hi, this is Tim McGarry from the McGarry Mortgage Minute. Heard every Wednesday right here on All Marine Radio, where I'll answer all your mortgage questions from home buying to home financing, from VA to conventional loans to moving in. So don't miss it, the McGarry Mortgage Minute, right here on All Marine Radio, on the All Warrior Radio Network. And remember, my name is McGarry, and I'm here to help.
Find all of Tim McGarry's contact information on the Read Board page at allmarineradio.com.
All you veterans, listen up. This is Bob Nielsen, former Marine and founder of 100 Entrepreneurs Project. Turner Construction is looking for veterans with real-world leadership experience to join their team of professionals.
Hold on, Nielsen. Are we talking about a job or a career?
Matt, Turner Construction is a great company with global opportunities for veteran leaders who are looking to start professional careers. I know. I returned to Turner after I got back from Vietnam and retired after 50 years. I had a great career traveling the world leading teams of Turner employees as we built incredible projects.
Are they looking for me to have construction experience, Bob?
Absolutely not. Turner is looking for leaders who have led under pressure. We want leadership. So if you're led in Iraq or Afghanistan or any other contingency, Turner Construction is actively looking for you.
So, a career with competitive pay, good benefits, and a company seeking veteran leaders. That's what we're talking about.
Bingo. We're on the right road when a grunt can understand it. Good job, Mac.
I appreciate that there, Nielsen. How do I get the ball rolling? What do I do?
Just email your resume to jobs@allmarineradio.com. And I will personally contact you and we'll begin the process.
I love it. Turner Construction is looking for veteran leaders who are looking for careers to join their veteran-friendly team. Email Bob Nielsen at jobs@allmarineradio.com. Let's do it.
We all have the ability to touch the lives of those around us. Moms, dads, neighbors, teachers, friends. These are the people who are always there to listen when we need to talk. Though their actions may not always be monumental, they are always felt. To someone going through a difficult time, a text, a call, or a visit can mean so much. Reach out to the veterans in your life today. Let them know they're not alone. One simple act can make all the difference. That's the power of one. If you're a veteran in crisis or know one who is, visit VeteransCrisisLine.net for free 24/7 confidential support. Or call 1-800-273-8255 and press 1.
I'm good, but I have a story and I don't know where to start.
I'm good, but I feel alone in a crowd.
I'm good, but the past keeps coming back.
When the service member or veteran in your life says,
I'm good.
Are you really listening?
I'm good, but I can't get out of bed.
I'm good, but I can't sleep.
I'm good, but I feel overwhelmed.
I'm good, but I don't feel safe.
I'm good, but I still have nightmares.
I'm good, but I don't need any help.
I'm good,
but I don't feel anything anymore.
I'm good, but I can't live like this anymore.
I'm really not so good. Are you ready to listen?
Suicide prevention is everyone's responsibility. Listen to the veteran or service member in your life. If you are in crisis or know someone who is, call the Veterans Crisis Line and Military Crisis Line at 1-800-273-8255 and press 1 for free 24/7 confidential support.
You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
To Gary Owen. All right, let's see. You're going to hear more, a little bit more emphasis on the Native American side of the story as we kind of rotate the prism. All right, so you've seen an overview of the battle, two overviews, one a little bit more detailed, and now and you see a little bit more emphasis on the Native American side of the story.
Hello.
Whoops, hold on. Wrong one. It's called A Good Day to Die.
Sometime in the early spring of 1876, Sitting Bull climbed to a hilltop seeking a vision. In his dream, a great dust storm swirled down upon a small white cloud that resembled a Lakota village. Through the whirlwind, Sitting Bull could see soldiers marching. The little cloud was swallowed up for...
It's not you, it's me. It's not really me. Looks like the audio, the video is trying to spool. Be patient. Be patient. Like, what the hell? All right. So we'll reset that. We'll get to the 39-second mark, which is where we left off. Stand by.
Swallowed up for a time.
See how I'm good at that kind of stuff? That's right.
The storm eventually dissipated, and the village emerged unharmed. It was an encouraging dream. And in the spring of 1876, the Lakota needed encouragement.
Humanitarians may weep for the poor Indian and tell the wrongs he has suffered, but he is passing away. The American people need the country the Indians now occupy. Many of our people are out of employment. The masses need some new excitement. An Indian war would do no harm, for it must come, sooner or later. Mark Kellogg, Bismarck Tribune.
In his office in Chicago, General Philip Sheridan had already drawn up a plan that would send three columns of soldiers to drive Sitting Bull and the other defiant chiefs onto the reservations. One column, led by Brigadier General George Crook, was to move north from Fort Fetterman. Another, under Colonel John Gibbon, was to march east from western Montana. The third, commanded by General Alfred Terry, marched west from Fort Abraham Lincoln. With him went the 566 enlisted men and 31 officers of the 7th Cavalry, led by George Armstrong Custer. They moved out to the tune of The Girl I Left Behind Me.
General George A. Custer, dressed in a dashing suit of buckskin, is prominent everywhere. The general is full of perfect readiness for a fray with the hostile Red Devils. And woe to the body of scalp lifters that comes within reach of himself and brave companions in arms. Bismarck Tribune.
None of the commanders knew precisely where Sitting Bull and his followers were, but they were confident that one column or another would find and destroy them. On June 6th, some 3,000 Lakota and Cheyenne were camped along Rosebud Creek in Montana. There, they held their most sacred ritual, a sun dance, in which prayers were offered and vows made to Wakantanka, their great spirit. Sitting Bull slashed his arms 100 times as a sign of sacrifice. Then he had another vision. The soldiers came again to attack his people. As many as grasshoppers, he said. But this time, they were upside down, their horses' hooves in the air, their hats tumbling to the ground as they rode into the Lakota camp.
He has this tremendous vision that he tells the people about, that the soldiers are going to fall into the camp and that there's going to be this great victory. And armed with this vision, the warriors go out looking for somebody to fight.
On the morning of June 17th, General Crook's column had stopped to brew coffee on the bank of the Rosebud, sure that no Indians would dare attack so large a force as theirs. Suddenly, Crazy Horse and more than 500 Sioux and Cheyenne warriors rode down upon them. Sitting Bull's arms were too swollen from the Sundance to fight, but he urged the young men into battle. Crook's command included Crow and Shoshone scouts, eager to fight their enemies, the Cheyenne and Lakota, who had once taken their lands. In the fierce, desperate fight that followed, the Indian scouts twice rescued the soldiers by riding through the Lakota and Cheyenne ranks. Unnerved by the enemy show of force, Crook withdrew the next morning. The Lakota and Cheyenne moved north and formed a new camp, where for 6 days they celebrated their victory along a winding stream they called the Greasy Grass. Whites called it the Little Bighorn. On June 21st, Custer met on the Yellowstone River with Colonel Gibbon and their superior, Brigadier General Alfred Terry. They knew nothing of Crook's retreat. Terry ordered Gibbon to march to the mouth of the Little Bighorn, while Custer and the 7th Cavalry, if they could locate the Indians, would drive them down the valley toward Gibbon and annihilation. As Custer rode off, Gibbon called out to him, "Now, Custer, don't be greedy. Wait for us." "No," he said, "I will not.
I now have some Crow scouts with me. They are magnificent-looking men. So much handsomer and more Indian-like than any we have ever seen. And jolly and sportive. Nothing of the gloomy, silent red man about them. They said they had heard that I never abandoned a trail. That when my food gave out, I ate mule. That was the kind of man they wanted to fight under. They were willing to eat mule, too."
"I know 5 of those scouts. They were old men when I was a young fella."
The just, again, remember, the Crow Scouts come with Custer. Hold on, let me make sure I have that right. I think I have that backwards. The Crow Scouts aren't organic to Custer. They're more familiar with the region. Right? And they know the land of the Little Bighorn better. The Arikara Scouts. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that name. If you've never been to in North Dakota, they're called Timeout Wachipi, and they're gatherings of the Sioux Nation. They're incredibly interesting to attend. Between the native dress and then the beating of the drums and the way they do their voice. I mean, they're not normal sounds. It's pretty impressive to watch.
Including my grandfather, White Man Runson.
Why?
What the tribe of Indians decided to fight other tribes in behalf of the white men. Sioux won't let us forget that. They always say, you Crows are no good. You're white lovers. You help them fight against us. But they forgot the fact that they came out here to annihilate us, take our land away from us. So there was a matter of protection.
Fearful that Sitting Bull would elude him, Custer pushed his column hard under a merciless prairie sun. 12 miles the first day, 33 the second, 28 the third. The exhausted troopers began to grumble about the man they privately called Hardass. They found the Indians' trail, but did not grasp the full meaning of the fresh layers of pony tracks that seemed to cross and recross it. In the last few days, 3,000 more Indians, Lakota, Arapaho, and Cheyenne, had left the reservations to join Sitting Bull. Their encampment now stretched for 3 miles along the greasy grass. In it were more than 6,000 Indians. 1,800 of them were warriors.
Now, you've seen that number change, right? In the last documentary, it was 10 to 12,000 with between 3 and 4,000 warriors. Right? So now you hear another number, 1,800 warriors, 6,000 people total.
On the evening of June 24th, Sitting Bull made his way to a ridge that overlooked the encampment. There he made offerings to the Great Spirit and prayed for the protection of his people.
Wakan Tonka, pity me. In the name of the people, I offer you this sacred pipe. Wherever the sun, the moon, the earth, the four points of the wind, there you are, always. Save the people, I beg you. We want to live. Guard us against all misfortune. Pity me. Tatranka Iyatranka.
The next day was June 25th, a Sunday, cloudless and hot. Custer's Crow Scout spotted the village from a distant hilltop. They called Custer up to have a look. Even with a telescope, he was unable to see much more than a white blur on the valley floor. His only concern was that he had already been spotted, that unless he attacked right away, the Indians would split up and flee in so many different bands that he could never stop them.
Custer had never yet encountered an Indian band that wouldn't run when the cavalry attacked. So he pushed to an attack as quickly as it could be mounted. dreadful mistake on his part because his men were exhausted. He should have bivouacked, given them a night's sleep, sent out some scouts to find out how far that village extends.
Stephen Ambrose, right? He's the writer of Band of Brothers.
Misdirection in that because much of it was hidden by woods along the Little Bighorn.
He knew nothing of the terrain, could not tell how many Indians awaited him. But it had been a surprise attack that had allowed him to destroy Black Kettle Cheyenne on the Washita 8 years earlier. A victory here seemed just as likely. Custer hurried toward the Little Bighorn. He saw dust rising over a ridge just ahead of him. The Indians, he thought, were already on the move to escape. It was now or never. Some 40 warriors appeared. Then,
okay, so Custer's all good up to this point, other than maybe ignoring it was given that said to him, hey, you know, wait for me. Don't try to take all the glory for yourself. He knows them, right? They know each other from the Civil War and also from fighting out on the plains. So Custer, you can defend everything Custer does up until this point. And saying that, look, we were spotted. And as you heard in previous things that I've read in terms of estimates of the situation that the Army did, right, they were expected to be no more than 800. And on contact, they would flee like they always did. So you had to trap them to get them to fight. Okay, so he's on terra firma relative to military decision-making at this point.
And began racing back toward their camp. Custer sent Major Marcus Reno in three companies, 140 men in pursuit, promising to support them.
Okay, so here you have Reno crosses Little Bighorn, as you can see on the map, right? And Custer says, I'm going to support you. What does that mean? Okay. You might want to during the walkthrough, right, on the terrain model, you might want to get a little clarity. What does that mean? Are you going to follow and trace? How are you going to, you going to have your own supporting attack? What can I expect?
The Battle of the Little Bighorn was about to begin.
It was somewhere past the middle of the afternoon, and all of us were having a good time. We found our women friends bathing in the river, and we joined them. Other groups were playing in the water. Two Sioux boys came running toward us. They were shouting, "Soldiers are coming!" We heard shooting. We hid in the brush. Kate Bighead.
Reno's men crossed the river, formed a thin skirmish line, and began firing into one edge of the village, assuming that Custer would reinforce them. They were soon outnumbered. Reno ordered a retreat.
Okay, on the map, it'll be Reno's movement to his second position.
The soldiers were falling into the village, just as Sitting Bull's vision had suggested they would. More Indian warriors swarmed out of the village. And still, Custer did not come. Instead of following Reno into the valley, he had led his five companies of 210 men toward a ridge, convinced the Indians were fleeing, and that by charging down into the village from there, he could cut them off.
Now, I'm not sure where that comes from. Like, how does he know that? But the argument that he's convinced. What has he seen that would convince him? If he saw, and this is just me, and this is one of the good parts about this battle study. If Custer can see that valley, right, he becomes a village idiot for thinking that he can take on that much, right? And so I don't even think he, with call it arrogance, call it combat confidence, based on his military record, long distinguished military record. I mean, even he can count. Okay, so I don't think until he drops down into that wash and attempts to cross the first time, I think he's operating on his assumptions and what he, you know, their estimate that no more than 100, 800 warriors in this group, and so maybe 3,000 total, and he's going to try to cut them off. I think that's valid. So.
He sensed,
but I don't think he at any point saw how large that was until he attempts to cross the river the first time.
Some of his scouts to go look over the hill. They came back, told him, well, they're still there. So he decided to go look himself. He would look over there, and pretty soon he beat it back. It was all choked up, as they say. You know, my grandfather used to say, Custer looked whiter than ever.
Custer was outnumbered more than 4-1, but he led his troops down toward the village, firing as they came. Cheyenne warriors led by Lame White Man, Hung Papa Lakota under Gaul, and Oglala under Crazy Horse rode out to turn Custer back. Custer's men stopped short, stunned at the sight of hundreds of warriors headed right at them.
It appeared there would be no end to the rushing procession of warriors. They kept going, going, going. I wanted to go too. I had seen other battles in past times. I always liked to watch the men fighting.
Okay, so on your map, this is number 9, the Medicine Tail Coulee. All right, where this engagement takes place.
The soldiers began a headlong retreat toward the summit of a long, high ridge. Some of the Indians remembered later that the legs of the men and the horses trembled as they scrambled up the slope.
I called to my men, "This is a good day to die. Follow me." As we rushed upon them, the soldiers dismounted to fire, but they did very poor shooting. They held their horses' reins on one arm while they were shooting, but their horses were so frightened that they pulled the men all around. And a great many of their shots went up into the air and did us no harm. Low Dog.
I charged in. A tall, well-built soldier saw me coming. When I rushed him, he threw his rifle at me without shooting. We grabbed each other and wrestled there in the dust and smoke. He hit me with his fists on the jaw and shoulders, then grabbed my long braids with both hands, pulled my face close, and tried to bite my nose off. I yelled as loud as I could to scare my enemy, but he would not let go. Finally, I broke free. He drew his pistol. I wrenched it out of his hand and struck him with it 3 or 4 times on the head. Knocked him over, shot him in the head, and fired at his heart. Ho Hechito. That was a fight. A hard fight. But it was a glorious battle. I enjoyed it. White Bull.
The shots quit coming from the soldiers. Warriors who had crept close to them began to call out that all the white men were dead. All of the Indians were saying these soldiers went crazy and killed themselves. I do not know. I could not see them. But I believe they did so. Wooden Leg.
I saw several different ones of the soldiers not yet quite dead. The Indians cut off arms or legs or feet of these, the same as was done for the entirely dead. Some of the women mourning for their own dead beat and cut the dead bodies of the white men.
The soldiers, one Lakota remembered, were as good men as ever fought. But the fighting, recalled another, had lasted no longer than a hungry man needed to eat his lunch. In the end, all of the men in Custer's command, 210 of them, lay dead. It was the greatest Indian victory of the Plains Wars. Two Cheyenne women were said to have found Custer's body.
The women pushed the point of a sewing awl into each of his ears, into his head. This was done to improve his hearing, as it seemed he had not heard what our chiefs in the South had said when he smoked the pipe with them. They told him then that if ever afterward he should break that peace promise and should fight the Cheyennes, the Everywhere Spirit surely would cause him to be killed. I often have wondered if, when I was riding among the dead where he was lying, my pony may have kicked dirt upon his body. Cape Big Head.
With our husbands away campaigning against the Indians, our only pleasure after the torrid day was to gather on someone's porch in the long twilight, enjoy what little music we could muster, and try to forget our worries and the devilish mosquitoes. Many among us had sweet voices, and while I played the guitar, everyone sang. Then, glancing across the parade ground, we noticed small groups of soldiers talking excitedly together, and several people came running toward us, faces set and wild-eyed. One was Horned Toad, the Indian scout, who gasped in short, sharp sentences, "Custer killed. Whole command killed." The guitar slipped from my knees to the floor. The pink ball of knitting fell out of Charlotte Moreland's hands. The letter, lying idly in Mrs. Benteen's lap, fluttered over the rail and onto the lawn. Catherine Gibson.
Americans were celebrating their centennial that summer, proud of 100 years of independence. The news that Custer and all the men of his command had been killed by Indians was greeted with simple disbelief. How could such a thing possibly have happened? How could mere Indians, with names that sounded absurd to Eastern ears, Low Dog, Crazy Horse, Sitting Bull, have defeated so celebrated a soldier? General Philip Sheridan, architect of the plan that had ended in disaster, promised Custer would be avenged. Washington hurried 2,500 additional cavalrymen west.
If you look at the Battle of the Little Bighorn, it was Custer's last stand, but in a lot of ways, it was a last stand for Indian people as a free people, as a people that were living on the plains and a lifestyle that was going to change because of that victory.
Fresh blue columns, commanded by Crook, Terry, and Colonel Nelson Miles, crisscrossed the Powder River country, hunting down the bands that had split up after the Custer fight. One by one, they were forced to surrender. Indians who had had nothing to do with the fighting were disarmed and had their ponies seized and sold.
Whatever we do, Wherever we go, we are expected to say yes, 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 yes. And when we don't agree at once to what you ask of us in council, you always say, you won't get anything to eat. Standing Elk.
Despite the Fort Laramie Treaty, Congress took away the Black Hills and another 40 million acres of Lakota land. The reservation chiefs were made to agree to all of it. But Sitting Bull still held out. He and his followers were beyond the reach of American troops, across the border in Canada, which he called the Land of the Grandmother, in honor of Queen Victoria. When General Alfred Terry traveled north to offer him a full pardon on the condition that he settle on a reservation, Sitting Bull angrily sent him away.
This country is my country now, and I intend to stay here and raise my people to fill it. We did not give our country to you. You stole it. You come here to tell lies. When you go home, take them with you.
All right, one more segment. And this is a Sitting Bull's account of what happened that day. And I'm sorry, Crazy Horse. Crazy Horse, a war fighter. Sitting Bull, a spiritual leader at this point in his career. So, with that said.
Hello, and welcome to the Past Times Media Series. Today I want to share with you Crazy Horse's personal account about the Battle of the Little Bighorn as it appeared in the Bismarck Tribune on June 11, 1877. It is believed that this is the first published Indian narrative of the battle, and the article is as follows.
The which would have made it almost a year after June 25th of 1876. So, here you have it. But you can see the Bismarck Tribune was the newspaper in terms of reporting on the war on the plains.
The Custer Fight, an Indian version of the massacre from the lips of Crazy Horse himself. The village was attacked by a strong force at 11 o'clock in the morning at the upper end of the village. This was a force commanded by Major Reno, and very shortly afterward, the lower end of the village was attacked by another strong force, that commanded by Custer. The village was divided into seven different bands of Indians, each commanded by a separate chief, and extended in nearly a straight line. The bands were in the order mentioned below, commencing from the lower end, where Custer made his attack. First, the Hunkpapas, under Sitting Bull. Second, the Oglalas, under Crazy Horse. Third, the Minikaju, under Fast Bull. Fourth, the Sans Arc, under Red Bear. Fifth, the Cheyenne, under Ice Bear. Sixth, the Santee and Yanktonay under Red Point of the Santee. Seventh, the Blackfeet under Stabby Head. The village consisted of 1,800 lodges and at least 400 wickiups, a lodge made of small poles and willows for a temporary shelter. Each of the wickiups contained four young bucks, and the estimate made by Crazy Horse is that each lodge had from three to four warriors. An estimate of the three made a fighting force of 7,000 Indians. This is the lowest estimate that can be made, for there were a good many Indians without shelter, hangers-on, who fought when called upon, and the usual number was much above 7,000. The attack was a surprise and totally unlooked for.
I just know that all right, so this is Crazy Horse's. These are Crazy Horse's numbers. Every number you've heard of is between 1,800 and 4,000. His account, 7,000.
When Custer made the charge, the women, papooses, children, and in fact all that were not fighters, made a stampede in a northerly direction. Custer, seeing so numerous a body, mistook them for the main body of Indians, retreating and abandoning their villages, and immediately gave pursuit. The warriors in the village, seeing this, divided their forces into two parts, one intercepting Custer between the non-combats and him, and the other getting in his rear. Outnumbering him as they did, they had him at their mercy, and the dreadful massacre ensued. Hornhorse says that the smoke and dust was so great that foe could not be distinguished from friend. The horses were wild with fright and uncontrollable. The Indians were knocking each other from their steeds, and it is an absolute fact that young bucks in their excitement and fury killed each other, several dead Indians being found killed by arrows.
When you look at the map, you can see the envelopment that gets done to the far west. So after Custer attempts to cross at Medicine Hat Coulee and pulls back up, again, you know, was there no chance for him, you know, to continue to move north and use mobility as his only weapon, really, in face of these numbers?
Horned Horse represented this hell of fire and smoke and death by interrunning his fingers and saying, "Just like this, the Indians and white men." These chiefs say that they suffered a loss of 58 killed and over 60 wounded. From their way of expressing it, I should judge that about 60% of their wounded died. While this butchery was going on, Reno was fighting in the upper part of the village, but did not get in so far as to get surrounded and managed to escape. They say had he got in as far as Custer, considering over half the village could join the northern portion in besieging him, the Indians claim that but for the timely arrival of General Terry, they would have got Reno. They would have surrounded and stormed him out, or would have besieged him and eventually captured him. From what I know of Crazy Horse, I should say that he no doubt is capable of conducting such a siege. In both the Rosebud fight and the Custer massacre, the Indians claim he rode unarmed into the thickest of the fight, invoking the blessing of the Great Spirit on him. That if he was right, he might be victorious. And if he was wrong, that he might be killed. To get the complete article, I would encourage you to visit fortlincoln.com. This article appears in full in the Custer Fight, Crazy Horse's Testimony of the Seventh's Defeat, in the fall issue of The Past Times, Volume 15, Number 3.
All right, there you have Crazy Horse's account of it. And again, it all runs along the same narrative of the initial attack comes from the east, which is Reno, and does not get very far into the valley of the Little Bighorn, and he is repulsed, and then Custer makes his appearance in the Medicine Hat Tail Coulee, in the Medicine Tail Coulee, I think I said trail before, and there. They go bump. Custer then bounces, if you will, further to the west, and it's up on that ridgeline when they get up there. Now the question is, at that point, were they already surrounded? Is that why he didn't move? I have yet to hear any Indian narrative from, it doesn't matter what tribe, any Native American narrative that discusses that, right? And I'm not sure you're going to find that. Some of the imponderable questions is, you know, are, were they out of gas? And so they stopped there, incapable of moving forward, so they defended themselves. Were they cut off? So, Battle of the Little Bighorn. We'll take one more break, come back, give you some thoughts, and then what I want to do is we'll do a second installment. I'm not sure if we'll do it next week, but I've got a couple authors that have said they'd like to come on and talk about it. And so so we'll do that along with kind of the Army War College look at course of action development, yada, 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 and then decision points on the battlefield. So break it down kind of military style. And so you have kind of the narrative, and you've heard it from the general to the more specific to include the Native American perspective. And again, what's important about the Native American perspective is the battle that they had got into with Gibbon, Colonel Gibbon, previous to this, right, that they had turned him back. So they knew they had, you know, the power to fight. And so they were not hesitant about it, especially when such a large group would be attacked. In fact, one of the accounts that I read said, and it might have been Sitting Bull's account, said that he was shocked that an army unit would attack such a large gathering of Native Americans. That when he heard the initial shooting, he thought, they're not attacking, you know, us when we're in this large of an organization. So interesting. So more battlefield study. Part one of George Armstrong Custer. We'll finish up when we come back. Don't touch that dial. More of All Radio, All Marine Radio, coming up next right here on your home for it, the All Warrior Radio Network.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.
Hi, this is Tim McGarry from the McGarry Mortgage Minute. Heard every Wednesday right here on All Marine Radio, where I'll answer all your mortgage questions from home buying to home financing, from VA to conventional loans to moving in. So don't miss it. The McGarry Mortgage Minute, right here on All Marine Radio, on the All Warrior Radio Network. And remember, my name is McGarry, and I'm here to help.
Find all of Tim McGarry's contact information on the ReadBoard page at allmarineradio.com.
To be fully fit, you have to be physically fit. You also have to be mentally fit.
I wish that more warriors would realize how important it is if you get the psychological support that you need so that you can focus on the rest of your life.
I think it takes strength in order to admit that you have an issue. But it also takes intuitiveness of a friend, a leader, a supervisor to pick up on the signal that the soldier is having issues and needs to seek professional help in dealing with it.
It's also important for the lowest possible levels of leadership to be very supportive in helping their members get the help that they need.
When I went to get help, I had more help than I could ask for from my entire command.
It's sometimes challenging to come to a senior staff member or senior officer in the unit with a problem. There's not a commanding officer out there or a leadership staff out there that doesn't want to help. So don't hesitate. Come ask.
Learn more by visiting www.realwarriors.net or calling 1-866-966-1020.
Hundreds of thousands of veterans have taken off their uniforms and put them away, carefully packed and safely stowed. But for some veterans, the uniform isn't so easily removed. The emotions experienced while serving continue to weigh on them. Life after service is different. Many veterans find transitioning difficult, and daily life is no longer as enjoyable as it once was. Some feel overwhelmed and lost. But that uncertainty doesn't take away from their strength and courage, nor does it take away from the sense of duty veterans carry with them. The transition from service is different for everyone. If you are a veteran going through a difficult time, or know one who is, the power of one person, one connection, one act of compassion can make a difference. For free 24/7 confidential support, call the Veterans Crisis Line at 1-800-273-8255 and press 1, or visit veteranscrisisline.net.
All you veterans, listen up. This is Bob Nielsen, former Marine and founder of the 100 Entrepreneurs Project. Turner Construction is looking for veterans with real-world leadership experience to join their team of professionals.
Hold on, Nielsen. Are we talking about a job or a career?
Matt, Turner Construction is a great company with global opportunities for veteran leaders who are looking to start professional careers. I know. I returned to Turner after I got back from Vietnam and retired after 50 years. I had a great career traveling the world leading teams of Turner employees as we built incredible projects.
Are they looking for me to have construction experience, Bob?
Absolutely not. Turner is looking for leaders who have led under pressure. We want leadership. So if you're led in Iraq or Afghanistan or any other contingency, Turner Construction is actively looking for you.
So, a career with competitive pay, good benefits, and a company seeking veteran leaders. That's what we're talking about.
Bingo. We're on the right road when a grunt can understand it. Good job, Mac.
I appreciate that there, Nelson. How do I get the ball rolling? What do I do?
Just email your resume to jobs@allmarineradio.com, and I will personally contact you and we'll begin the process.
I love it. Turner Construction is looking for veteran leaders who are looking for careers to join their veteran-friendly team. Email Bob Nielsen at jobs@allmarineradio.com. Let's do it. You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network. All right, in the post it all update here. It'll go from the read board to the podcast thing as I attach the audio to it. I'm going to attach three documents that I've been taking a look at, all right? And if you're interested, if you find the studying the Battle of the Little Bighorn, I think when you attempt to layer modern military theory and what we think a staff would do, and you try to layer it over over operations in and around the Little Bighorn, you see glaring mistakes. The commanding officer dominated those commands, and Custer was no shrinking violet when it came to dominating the landscape. So what you'll see attached to the website is something written. One of them was written in 1989. It comes out of Armor Magazine. Defeat at Greasy Grass: Intelligence Operations at the Battle of Little Bighorn. So that's written by First Lieutenant Stephen J. Martin. I'll also attach a pretty interesting something I read last night. Custer Battlefield National Monument, Montana, now Little Bighorn Battlefield, by Robert M. Utley, National Park Service Historical Handbook, Series Number 1, Washington, D.C., 1969. And in that, it's a very comprehensive look at it, to include interviews with people like Gall, who you heard discussed, things that he saw, Low Dog's account. So you see a number of different accounts in this thing. There's maps, and I think it's very, very good comprehensive look at the battle. You'll also see something that one of our listeners sent me. The article out of Armor is from him as well. This is a Masters of Military Studies done at Marine Corps Command and Staff College, and it's done by Jonathan T. Newman, Major, U.S. Army. And Dr. Donald Bittner, who was a figure at Command and Staff for years, I'm not sure if he's still there or not, he was the mentor. But the title is The Military Decision-Making Process and the Battle of the Little Bighorn. So I will post that there for your reading enjoyment as well. And then what we'll do is I'll see if I can get a couple of writers who've written about this to come on and talk about their thoughts relative to the Battle of the Little Bighorn. But again, I believe to understand the events there, because some of the events defy logic. And if you have not read about Lieutenant Colonel George A. Custer, if you don't know his extended service in the Civil War, and how that experience shaped him, then I don't know that you can understand the prism through which he looks at events when he comes onto them. And he's been a fortunate man. He's had great luck in combat, and often pushing the boundaries of common sense. And yet he gets away with it. And I think that when he takes that same chance in the Valley of the Greasy Grass, otherwise known as the Little Bighorn, you could argue that what should have happened to him years ago ultimately happens. So, again, there's a certain point up to which you can argue that he's doing the right thing. His telling Reno that he would support his attack, Reno doesn't know how, obviously a failure to communicate on his part. Him not understanding that there's nobody else coming, and this better go my way, and if I see indicators that say it's not going my way, I better get out of this quick, or else I'll lose the whole command, he doesn't have in his head. In his head, I mean, you can imagine when he ultimately winds up in a place where he will die. You know, you can imagine what was going through his head. Holy shit, where did this come from? So, again, if you can't tell, I've always been fascinated by this, and absolutely positively enjoy doing it. That'll do it on a Wednesday hump day. If you're just tuning in, we'll check the news. Bob Woodward in the news. Yeah, he did not. He did not join. The rest of the networks, taking the task, the president, over the revoking of Jim Acosta's news credential. Headline in the New York Post, Fox News backs CNN's lawsuit over Jim Acosta's suspended press pass. Quote, Fox News supports CNN in its legal effort to regain its White House reporters' press credentials, Fox News President Jay Wallace said in a statement. We intend to file an amicus brief with the U.S. District Court. Secret Service passes for working White House journalists should never be weaponized, he added. While we don't condone the growing antagonistic tone by both the president and the press in recent media avails, we do support a free press, access to open exchanges for the American people. Here's what I don't. So it's his right to cover the White House in any way he chooses to do so, regardless of the standards that I have. Let's just say McNamara becomes president of the United States. That guy's rude and he offends me. I went to move on in my press conference, and he wanted to hold a debate with me. I won't allow that. CNN can send another reporter. We're not banning its coverage. We're saying that because of the way he conducts himself, we no longer want him here. I no longer want him here. He's free to cover. He can stand outside the White House. But when I say next question, that's not his cue. And let me tell you the other problem. The problem is the way they actually conduct the briefing. Handing the microphone around. When you hand a microphone to the reporter, you've empowered them to ask multiple questions. So I would look for that to get tweaked, that there will somehow or other be a boom mic, and it will get moved around. And when the president decides to move on, the president will move on. I think the whole handing them the microphone hands them the control of the interview. So I just don't, you know, if again, whether I like his line of questioning or not, the president has a right when he says, next question, not to get yelled at by some reporter who doesn't think it's right. The president of the United States should be allowed to do that. It's his press conference. And the people working it shouldn't have to deal with reporters that won't cooperate. And so based on your lack of cooperation, based on your rudeness to your peers, we don't want you here. Why is that unreasonable? He can report on the White House all he wants. He just won't be included in the press pool. I'll be curious to see how that turns out. Does he have a constitutional right? Again, CNN's coverage, reporters aren't universally unwelcome. Just him. I don't think that's, in my opinion, you're not infringing on the media. You're saying by virtue of his conduct, we don't want him here. That's different. Anyway. On this Wednesday. So you'll hear about that a little bit. The day we do battlefield study. A battle that I've long been interested in. But I don't, again, me personally, I don't think it's that the answers to the questions are not very complex. I think they begin and end in the head of Lieutenant Colonel George Armstrong Custer. And if you read about him, you read about his history, you understand the way he operates. The things that I say, the way I would have looked at him, did not go through his head that day. And I would say he was probably the most shocked person on the battlefield when he headed up that hill. And whether he was surrounded, or they ran out of gas, or he chose to fight there, any of those things. He was the most stunned guy on the planet. What happened? How could I not have seen this? And the reason he didn't see it was because he had blinders on. Blinders he had had on for years, but he never got caught. So, on Wednesday, have a great day. All Marine Radio is over and out.